Brother Paul has asked that we would read from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 19. The first verse that we'll be reading has two imperatives in it: be sober and hope to the end. And the verse begins with the word wherefore. If we look back at the first 12 verses, we see in verse 9 another time, or he has already used the word the end. In verse 9, he says, the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. And there's that sense of an end. In verse 5, he talks about the last time. And in verse 11, he looks ahead to the glory that should follow. And as we read through these verses, there's a sense that we are in right now, we're in now, but that now is temporary and intermediate, and there's a greater time to follow. And then there is the implication, verse 13, with those two imperatives and throughout the passage, that considering what is to follow, there is an obligation placed on us now. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 19. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance, but as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. And if ye call on the Father, who without respect of persons judgeth according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear. Forasmuch as ye know that ye were not redeemed with corruptible things, as silver and gold, from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. All those who are able, let's kneel together in prayer.
We greet you this morning in our Lord's name as we like to think about this, the topic of be holy in conduct. We notice in the passage here that it says that we are to be holy in all manner of conversation. That is, we are to be holy in every aspect of our life. And I actually, when I was led to this topic, I was not considering what the Bible study topic might be in the morning, but charity goes along with this very well. And I think we look at the aspect that God says he is holy, and God says that he is love. They are not so much just characteristics of God as really they define who God is. God is holy. God is love. And often when we talk about love or holiness, we tend to set them in competition with one another, and they are never intended to be in competition with one another because they both flow from God, who is not in competition with himself. And so everything this morning that we share on the topic of holiness, it is our prayer that it also is delivered in the spirit of love, because these are the words of the Lord and they've been delivered to us in the spirit of love and for our best interest. We'd like to go through this passage and look at some of the key phrases. I recognize that this passage could certainly be preached in a completely different way, but we have chosen this topic of holiness because certainly it is prominent in this passage. Beginning there in verse 13, wherefore gird up the loins of your mind. And if you would look at it in a more modern translation, it would probably say something like to the effect of preparing your minds. And so a literal translation, it is literally, gird up the loins of your mind. The meaning of that is prepare your minds. That was would have been the typical expression that would have been used in Bible times to tell someone to pay attention, to think carefully. But it's also a very male expression, because you never read in Scripture for a woman to gird up the loins of her mind. In fact, in Job it says, gird up the loins of your mind like a man, or gird up your loins like a man. And the thought here is that the man would wear an outer robe, and underneath the outer robe was a tunic. And when he was going to work or to war, he would gather up his long flowing robe that got in the way, and he would tuck it into his belt. And so that comes from that comes the expression of get ready to work or get ready to war. Get your robe out of the way so it's not encumbering you. And if we look at this in the analogy of Ephesians 6, where the belt that the believer wears is the belt of truth. So gird up your robe and tuck it into the belt of truth. We also see this idea of the robe, this outer robe, being a picture of the identity of the person. The robe was often expressive of the family or your station in society. If you were a judge, you would wear a certain robe, and we see that even carrying through today. If you were in a certain family, you would wear a robe that would define you as being part of that family. And we see this thought coming out in the picture of the prodigal son returning to the father. Put on him the best robe. In other words, it's a symbol of acceptance back into the family. And so Peter is using these analogies to say that what I'm going to tell you, it's not intended for casual listening, but rather I'm asking you to have a dedicated focus of your mind on this topic. The fact that he uses a male expression to say, listen up, I think is a clear indicator that he's asking for men to take the lead. Men, take the lead and be willing to engage with the truth. Tuck your own robe of personal identity into the belt of truth and let truth govern your identity. Next, he says, be sober. That's another way of saying take this seriously. Now, it's interesting, this word sober, we still use it today in the sense of being free from intoxication. And that is still the root meaning of the word. The root meaning is think soberly, but in order to think soberly, you need to be free of all other intoxicating influences. In other words, all outside influences, whether it's emotional, whether it's worldly, whether it's a substance, any influence on your mind that would deviate you from the truth, you need to recognize that, be sober, put it aside, don't be under those intoxicating influences, because I'm asking you to think seriously about the truth. Peter is saying, don't pass this off lightly, don't be dismissive of this. And then he uses another phrase, and hope. So you gird up, you be sober, and you hope. Now hope might be looked at as maybe that's sort of a strange mix in this set of instructions. Man up, take heed, and hope. But let's notice the full phrase, hope to the revelation of Jesus Christ, hope to the end. He's really saying take the long view. The hope that you have in your heart is all in relation to what's going to happen in the future. So I'm asking you to think in the present. Think about the most blessed hope that you have in your life. Is it not the revelation of Jesus Christ? So I'm asking you to think soberly in the present in relation to the future. I'm asking you to get your priorities and your perspective straight. Fix your hope on the grace which will be given at the appearing of Jesus Christ. The grace of God is our teacher. The grace of God is our divine empowerment. And it works with us in the present to prepare us for the future. In Ephesians, we're told that in the ages to come, he's going to show us the exceeding riches of his grace. Grace plays a big part of our future, and grace needs to be a big part of our present. And so grace is linked to our hope. Now let's look at this from another passage to help to bring this into perspective. 1 John chapter 3, verses 2 and 3 says, "Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself, even as he is pure." So there's a relationship between purity and holiness. There's a relationship between hope and how we live in the present in relation to the future. Everyone that has this hope, everyone that has the hope of Jesus Christ in his life, takes specific measures for purity. Everyone that has the hope of Jesus Christ in his life makes decisions in the present in relation to the future. So our hope is linked to the appearance of Jesus Christ when the grace of God is more fully revealed in the coming of Jesus Christ. Now this blessed hope, or this appearing of Jesus Christ, or the revelation of Jesus Christ, is also spoken of in Scripture in the picture of a wedding. Most of us who have been through weddings from our children recognize there's one thing about weddings, and that is they require a lot of preparation. I would say, at least for those who are getting married, they would hope that we would take it seriously, and they would hope that we would prepare. And it's actually very biblical for there to be a lot of preparation in relation to a wedding, because it's a very important event in the lives of a young couple. No, it's not intended to be a glamour show, but yet it is honoring something that God has ordained, and so there's a lot of preparation. This analogy goes forward in the parable of the virgins. The foolish virgins were those who did not prepare for this wedding, or who had stopped preparing because their lamps went out. The oil in that pitcher, or that parable, is a picture of the Spirit and the grace of God that keeps our lamps burning. The burning lamp is a picture of faith that the groom is still coming. So the grace of God works with our blessed hope to give us a long-range view and works to prepare us in the present to be ready for the future. Jesus is coming for a bride that has thought seriously about his coming, that lives in the present in hope of his coming, and the difference that makes in their life is significant, because our lamps are either burning or they are not. In verse 14, the phrase is used, obedient children. As obedient children, he's saying if we have the right positive view, notice what comes next. We will also have the right negative view. First, we must prepare for Jesus. In preparing for Jesus, there are things which we must not do. Verse 14, as obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance. Not fashioning. That is in the negative. The word fashioning is the same word as conform or conforming. It's the same word that's used in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, where it says, "Be not conformed to this world." So it's interesting that both in this passage and also in the passage in Romans 12, it is given in the negative. Nonconformity, or not fashioning yourself, is given in a negative context, something we are not to do. There are three primary meanings that relate to this idea of fashion or conformity. It means, number one, to have identity with. If you conform to something, or you fashion yourselves according to something, you're trying to take on the identity of that which you are conforming to. Number two, there's an outward or visible shape or form or pattern or expression of what is going on. In this conforming process, or in this fashioning process, there's going to be a visual image that's going to come out in this process. And number three, there's the idea that there is pressure involved, there's force involved. And so all of this is within the context of what is we're not to allow in the life of the believer. We are not to allow identity with the world, with the fashion of the world, with the conformity of the world. We're not to allow a visible identification with the world. We're not to allow the pressure of the world to force us into its mold. Now we can, as we look around the world, especially on social issues, we can see that there's tremendous pressure being put on society to adopt a new morality. The world system is trying to conform society to abandon any biblical values that were in our society, to conform to a new morality. And so all of that is given in the negative. And that's why James says it this way: whoever will be a friend of the world will be an enemy of God. We are to avoid outward or visible association with the fashion, the style, and the identity of this world system. And then we're given the reason why. Not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts. The world system is based on lust. All that is in the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. They are not of the Father. There's a negative again. They are not of the Father, but they are of the world. What does lust do? Lust prompts worship and service of the creature more than the Creator. Lust never magnifies Jesus Christ. Lust never magnifies God. Lust magnifies self. Lust magnifies the world system, which is based on self. And so what takes place as a society moves from truth to lust? Romans 1:25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is forever worthy of praise. Amen. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And as a result of exchanging the truth of God for a lie, the focus moves from the Creator to the creature. Moves from God, moves to self. Rather than living for God, I enhance myself. And the lust of the world is based on a lie. Not only is it based on a lie, but it is based on exchanging the truth for a lie. There are deliberate decisions made in the world system to reject truth and to project another image. And then there's this word ignorance. The meaning of the word ignorance is lack of knowledge or moral blindness. Peter is saying that the outward visible fashions of this world come from lust that is based on lack of knowledge or based on moral blindness. In other words, there are some who are caught up in the fashion of the world, following their own lusts, but really don't understand completely what they're doing, don't completely understand where it is leading them, don't completely understand the toll that it will take on their life. Because when we make a visible identification with the world, when we adopt the world's image, we are under pressure now to adopt the world's moral standards. And moral purity will begin to be compromised. So let's pause a moment on this point and see how it might work. In the world, men are tempted to think that their lives might be improved if they had a very beautiful woman for a wife. And I hope that to each one of us who's married, our wives are very beautiful. But for men of wealth and power, there's the idea of a trophy wife. When they can successfully exchange their current wives for another one that is perhaps younger and more beautiful. And that is simply a move that is made out of lust. Men are not satisfied with their wives. Men who are not satisfied with their wives will find other ways to feed their lust. And the fashions of this world feed that lust in men also. And you can see where they're the fashion of the world, also relates to the eyes of man and the lust of man to move from moral purity to moral impurity. The world is very much aware how visual images can move someone's moral standards, and we ought not to be ignorant of that. That is what Peter is saying. Don't be ignorant of the deliberate intent of the world system. This also feeds into other areas: status symbols, possessions, seeking fame and recognition. But it always comes back to the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, and elevating humans over their Creator. Now, God is certainly for order and beauty, because He looked at everything that He had made and He said it was very good. And if God says it's good, it is good. And God has given us beauty. God created beauty. God created godly beauty. And there's no godliness in deliberately erasing God's beauty. That is not what we're intending here this morning. But specifically, in order to be holy in all manner of conversation or in all manner of conduct and behavior, there needs to be a deliberate decision to reject the conformity or the fashion of this world. It is impossible to be holy without employing God's negative, which is to reject that which is against the holiness of God. It's interesting that the negative command actually precedes the positive command. The positive command is in verses 15 and 16, be holy. But the negative command comes first, not to be conformed or not to be fashioned. And I think this informs us that this is our first and our natural state. If left to our own thinking, we will embrace the world system. There needs to be a deliberate decision. Be sober. Gird up the loins of your mind. Make a deliberate decision. I will not be fashioned according to the world, because the only thing that I need to do in order to follow the fashion of the world is simply do nothing. Just simply go along with the world system. Just simply be a part of the peer pressure. Just simply be what everyone else is. The world uses pressure to conform people to its fashion. In contrast, God uses the conviction of truth to direct His people. God uses conviction of truth to motivate us to righteousness. And the world uses emotional and peer pressure to conform people to carnality. Conviction changes us from instability to steadfastness and stability, while the pressure of fashion creates anxiety to keep changing in order to stay in vogue. Conviction brings us into acceptance into the family of God, and fashion keeps us anxious as to whether we're in style enough to be accepted by those who look at us. Now let's look at holiness more closely, the definition of holiness. It's interesting that it stands almost as completely the opposite of what fashion or conformity is. Holiness carries with it the idea of being transformed into God's likeness, becoming godly. In the pagan world, there would have been an understanding of this, that it's whatever God you're serving, you're going to emulate that God. You're going to try to become like that God. And so even the Gentiles would have had the understanding of the relationship between holiness and following your God. The next element that's in holiness is being set apart for God, or being devoted unto God, having a specific service that involves dedication or devotion. There's the aspect of being morally pure. And for the pagan, this would have been embracing the morality of their God, which we know their gods were not holy. But the Lord Jehovah is a holy God. He says, be holy, for I am holy. And so the idea of holiness is adopting godliness as our standard. And then finally, there's a clear understanding that when I become holy, I am going to be different from the general world. This was even in pagan thinking, that if I am to be dedicated to the service of the gods, I am in sacred service. And that's in distinction from everyday common service. That was their way of looking at it. In the life of the believer, we are made holy in all manner of conversation. We don't simply have to go to a temple and become a priest or become dedicated to a specific set of services. That's the pagan concept of holiness. The believer's concept of holiness is we are normal working human beings, and we're holy in all manner of conversation because our whole lives are set apart in every manner, in every conversation, in every conduct. We present ourselves as holy to the Lord. Holiness and fashion both expect to use visual images. You cannot be in fashion unless you have evidence of being in fashion. You cannot be holy to the Lord unless there's visual evidence of being holy to the Lord. Holiness, as we've seen, begins with the rejection of fashion. The world will no longer provide my identity. However, here's a very important distinction. My Christian identity is not established by rejecting the world. I can reject the fashion of this world. I can set up a culture that's different from this world, and that does not mean that I have an identity with Jesus Christ. Rejecting the world does not give me any new identity with Jesus Christ. It just simply means I have rejected the world. People that focus, and I'll use the word obsess, over separation from the world are really still under the world's control because they're always forced to do something differently from the world. If the world does this, then I must do that. Their only identity is separation. That was the focus of the Pharisees. The word Pharisee means separatist. I think that somehow if I focus on separation and I separate myself from evil, I will somehow make myself holy. Holiness comes from the pursuit of godliness. Holiness comes with our identification with Jesus Christ. Holiness comes from being conformed to the image of His Son. That's the only way that holiness comes. But when that holiness takes place, there will automatically be a negative rejection of the world. But simply rejecting the world system does not make us holy. There are whole cultures that can be set up in separation from the world. And within those cultures, you can be just as lost as someone who is not separated from the fashion of the world. True holiness lies in becoming godly in all manner of conduct. The negative is separating from the world. The positive is moving towards God, pursuing holiness in every aspect of our life. The godly person is not looking at the world and trying to be different. They are different because they are pursuing holiness. To use some practical examples, a worldly and a godly worker might both wear Red Wing work boots because of their quality and their function. They may both climb up into a green John Deere tractor because they are convinced that that is the right brand to use farming. They might both use yellow DeWalt work tools because they are the best quality for the cost. Or they might sit at a desk that uses Microsoft software because, in their opinion, that is top tier. And so there are things that we will do in relation to our normal work and our duties that will be the same as the world. And if we're always trying to do something different from the world, that is not being guided by godliness. That's simply reacting to the world. But even though there are things which we do similarly, there will be some things which we will do very differently because we are not conformed to this world system. We're not being pressed into its mold. We're not being pressed into its values. And this will usually become very noticeable when we move into the area of fashion. The one embraces fashion and fuels their lust, and the other will reject those fashions which are designed to excite lust. Lust is identified as the marker for helping us reject fashion. Do we dress a certain way because it meets the form and function of our work? That is understandable. Do we dress a certain way because it puts us in fashion with the world? That is to be rejected. And often when we talk about this subject, it drifts towards the female. And I would like to use an example from the male side. Maybe some of you won't relate to this, but I think some of the males will. It was in around 2011, I wanted to buy a diesel truck. And my wife had some cautions about the expense and justification for our needs, and we talked through those things, and we decided to move ahead. So we bought this diesel truck, and we brought it home, and my wife was like a day or so later, she announced to me she's not driving my truck. And I said, why? She goes, well, when I go out the lane, it roars and it goes nowhere. I said, well, that's like you have to have enough RPM to spool up the turbo to make it go. Well, that's just like announcing to everybody I'm in a truck and here I'm going out the lane. That's not me. So I said, well, there is a way we can fix that. That's called putting a tune on it. She goes, what's a tune? Is that something that gives it more power? I said, yes. But it also gives it more fuel economy. And right away her alerts were up because she knew me as a young man and she knew what one of my trucks was like. And she knew where weaknesses were. And as we talked through this, we agreed to set some boundaries. And so I took it to the diesel shop and we discussed the type of tune, and I tried to very much emphasize what I wanted in this tune. That primarily what I was looking for was a daily driver tune to increase fuel economy and also to allow the transmission to shift sooner so that the truck didn't need to sound so loud until it actually was going. So he came up with a tune and he called me when it was done, and he said it turned out really well. He said, this truck is the perfect truck to put larger injectors in. He said, we could really get some horsepower out of this truck. I said, I'll come and drive it. I want some more horsepower, but I'm also primarily wanting this thing to pay for itself. He goes, that's what they all say to justify it to their wives, that they're doing this for fuel economy. But once you feel your foot in the throttle, you're going to change your mind. And then we'll talk injectors. And I said, no, I will drive it, but no, we're not going to talk injectors. So I came back, he goes, how do you like it? I said, I think you got what I'm looking for. I appreciate it. He goes, well, you know how it's going to be. You're going to get on it, and the transmission's going to go, and you're going to come back, and then we can do injectors and a transmission. As I looked at him, and I said, I understand what you're saying. He goes, I'm telling you, he said, everybody says what you say, and everybody comes back, and we do more. I'm just offering you, while I got it here, we'll do it all. And I said, I understand that your statistics are probably very accurate, but it is my plan to not be in your statistics. And thankfully to the Lord, that truck and that tune is still working well with the same transmission and with the same amount of horsepower. And I'm happy and my wife's happy. But the point in all of this is, she knew that in the right area of my life, there could be temptation to do more. And once you start down that road, the diesel shop already knew there's a profile of a certain individual that comes. And once they get started, they can't stop. That's how lust works in our life. If we don't have boundaries, and if we don't allow other people to help us establish boundaries. My wife knew, again, where I needed some encouragement to draw lines. All of us have different areas in our lives where we need encouragement from other people to draw lines. And I realize that that's not a perfect example for every application to everyone's life, but I think it illustrates the point that even in the areas where we can lawfully engage, there are temptations to go to excess. All manner of conduct, we are to be holy. We are to make announcement to the world that we are different. I remember coming home from the country of Ukraine with the family, and we were a bit scattered with the seating, and there was a man sitting beside my daughter, and eventually he got the attention of my wife, who got the attention of me, and the man said, is there any way that you could switch your seating because I'd like to talk to your husband? So we switched our seating around, and he goes, been watching your family. Said the first thing was I noticed how you dressed. Then I was watching how you interacted as a family. And he said, I would like to ask you some questions. And he was from South Africa. And it ended up being a faith discussion for the rest of the flight. God is asking us to be holy in all manner of conversation. We take certain steps. When we take certain steps and we make certain visual boundaries, it helps us in our holiness. In the early 1900s, the Church of the Brethren decided to drop all standards of nonconformity as a denomination, and to allow each congregation to decide for themselves what levels of conformity would be necessary or encouraged. But in turn, many congregations decided also to drop all standards of nonconformity, and they would allow each individual to decide for themselves, because no one wanted to own that discussion of working together. What happened? The denomination eventually largely embraced the fashion of the world. Congregations followed. Once they embraced the image of the world, they eventually embraced the values and the morality of the world, and we needed to separate from them. And the question is for us is, where will we go now? What will we become? Those choices lie with us. In this passage, we're reminded that Jesus Christ is the source of our redemption. The redemption of Christ implies ownership. We are not our own. We don't belong to ourselves, and we don't belong to the world. We belong to Jesus Christ. In fact, it talks about the contrast of being bought by Jesus Christ, redeemed by Jesus Christ, is contrasted from the vain conversation or vain conduct received by tradition from your fathers. Vain means empty or not satisfying or aimless or without worthy goals or temporaries or ever temporary or ever changing or ineffectual. That's how these traditions are described. And you might think that maybe he's talking about the Jews, but actually he's talking about the Gentiles. Because in chapter 2, verse 10, it talks about Peter's addressing the audiences here and says, which in time past were not a people, but now are the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy, referring to the Gentiles. Chapter 4, verse 3, he talks about the excess of their past life, that they walked in the excess of the Gentiles. So the traditions here are not Jewish traditions. They're worldly traditions. They're the traditions of that present world. And Peter is contrasting the tradition of the world with the redemption of Jesus Christ. And he's saying that he had formerly said that the world system is based on lust and ignorance. And now he's saying by the redemption of Jesus Christ, you can be delivered from the tradition of the world because the tradition of the world is emptiness. When you think about the tradition of the world, especially in relation to fashion, you know that at what at one time is in vogue and what at one time makes you appear as someone who's really in. Just give it 20 or 30 years and that person is hopelessly outdated. And the only thing that has changed is fashion. So fashion will betray itself in time. Fashion gives no stability to a person's life. It's ever changing. It's always leading you on the road of anxiety. Am I still in fashion? Have I changed enough? What's new that's coming out that I'm not aware of, that I should be aware of? And eventually, if I've followed fashion all my life and I get older, all of a sudden I'm faced with this challenge that I just can't look like I want to look. And I have an identity crisis, and we see old people with identity crisis trying to figure out how they can look young again. That's bondage. That's empty tradition. Now, in conclusion, let's think of this in the context of Palm Sunday. If you were there near Jerusalem that day and Jesus was coming in, and suppose you were off to the side and you heard this commotion and people were raising their voices, people were talking enthusiastically, and if you looked over, you saw palm branches raising and you walked in that direction, you say, what's going on? And they're saying, the king is coming. What king is coming? The Messiah is coming. You mean like the Messiah, the messianic hope? Yes, the messianic hope. It's Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. He's going to be the king. He's going to fulfill all our Jewish hope. Imagine the excitement. Where is he? Well, just go where you see the palm branches waving. They're announcing where he is. Look where the crowd is putting their garments in the street. And so there's those visual indicators that led the people to where Jesus was. There was a great attraction. The attraction was the physical presence of Jesus Christ. What is the attraction today? If I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men unto me. The cross is the attraction of Jesus Christ today. Our conduct follows that of the crucified Christ. Crucified by the world. We are crucified with him. We become part of his identity. And as Paul says, I am crucified unto the world, and the world is crucified unto me. But also in my crucifixion, I have a new identity, which is in Jesus Christ. It's my identity in Jesus Christ that makes all the difference. It's not being separated from the world. It's being separated unto Jesus Christ, being conformed unto Jesus Christ, which makes all the difference. And our lives become like the palm branches that are waving. You want to learn about Jesus Christ? You can come over here. When someone wants to get right with Jesus Christ, someone feels the attraction of Jesus Christ, do they know where to go? Can they identify you? No, it's not about just being separate from the world. It's about identifying with Jesus Christ.
In closing, I would like to say amen to what Brother Paul has shared. And a thought came to my mind, and I thought about it in past times. Am I sold out to Jesus Christ? That's what Paul's talking about this morning. If we're sold out, we're not going to want to follow the fashions of the world. We're going to want to follow after Christ. We're going to want to be called out. We're going to want to be a separate person. We're going to want to be a peculiar person. I don't know. I feel maybe we should have an invitation this morning. Brother Andy, you got a song that we could sing? Verse or two.